We'd like to welcome to the program one of the best chefs in the Lowcountry, a James Beard Award winner, chef and partner at Charleston's Fig and The Ordinary, a couple of great restaurants, and a guy who is spearheading a push to eliminate European tariffs on food, wine, and spirits on American restaurants. And we're going to talk to him about this and a lot more, because there's dozens of restaurants and bars in the Lowcountry and thousands across the country who are trying to get these tariffs removed. We say hello and welcome to Chef Mike Latta. Mike, how you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you today?
I'm doing fine. Thank you so much for joining us. What was it that led you to sort of spearhead this? I mean, I see dozens of bars and restaurants in the Tri-County area have joined you, and well over 2,000 bars and restaurants and wine businesses in the country have signed on to a letter that you're sending to President-elect Joe Biden to get these tariffs removed on day one of his administration. Can you explain how you got involved in this and what these tariffs do to the restaurant business and what it would do if these tariffs were to go away?
Yeah, so I certainly can't take credit for actually spearheading it. I'm one of the founding members of the coalition, and on that coalition, we've got a lot of great people in the wine industry at Capitol Hill consulting with us, helping us to, you know, lobby against these tariffs, because honestly, pandemic aside, it's an airline manufacturing problem, not a restaurant problem, and we're the ones that are dealing with the brunt of it.
When were the tariffs placed on the restaurants here in America?
So I believe it was October 19th. And then, you know, and they're revisited every once in a while. And there was a threat for these tariffs to go from 25% to 100% at certain times in 2020. And then, you know, and these tariffs are on all kinds of European goods, you know, that restaurants use, be it olive oil, be it cheeses and hams. But, you know, I would say most importantly, it's wines. You know, the EU wines that we buy, the old world wines, provide a tremendous value to the restaurant industry. So most of us that have serious wine programs, and even maybe not so serious wine programs, rely on the value and the quality of these old world wines to fill out our list and generate, you know, maybe the best profit center in the restaurant business. Now, this profit center isn't like a loophole that we found. It's part of the fabric of our costing and our business model. So most restaurants, for example, if you buy a Sancerre from France, this is a super high quality wine that we can charge, you know, $13, $14 a glass for. The equivalent of a California wine that met that same quality standard would probably cost another, you know, $7 or $8 a glass, right? Which would be pricing it out completely of our by the glass program. So we make a great margin on these wines because, listen, this land has been paid for years, whereas the land in Napa Valley goes for $1 million an acre. So the wines that we get from, you know, domestically are great and wonderful and well-made. However, they're not a swap out for these, you know, great valued, well-crafted wines from the European Union. So without these wines, our entire business model gets thrown off. You know, most restaurants like ours push a lot of wine and rely on those profits to buy us specifically more expensive ingredients domestically. Like, so our push for local produce and local, you know, seafood, all that stuff costs a lot of money, right? And we can't do it without this balancing act of what we can make a little more money on, better margins on. And, you know, so it really does kind of fund our labor structure, our labor model, and, you know, it's one big matrix of how this whole thing works for us. And if we have to pay an elevated price on these wines due to the tariffs, it really makes it so we'll have to cut back jobs, we'll have to buy imported products that are cheaper, and it really disrupts our value system. But most importantly, during the pandemic, is one more nail in the coffin for us to try to avoid before most of us close.
Yeah, it wouldn't be hard enough if there wasn't a pandemic going on, and you throw the pandemic on top of the restaurant tariffs. I mean, 25% tariffs on European food, wine, and drink products. And I believe me, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe Fig's wine program was recognized as one of the best in the countries, wasn't it?
Yeah, in 2019, we won the Best Wine Program in America from the James Beard Foundation.
So, speaking from an area of expertise, and at the same time, I mean, wine sales, that's a major profit driver. But then you mentioned the inputs, like things like cheese, olive oil, meat, and other foods. I mean, these tariffs make it even more difficult, as you said, even in the time of a pandemic, to stay in business and can cost jobs. I mean, what's the attitude, do you think, from the forthcoming Biden administration to visit this issue and try to get these tariffs removed to help the restaurant industry? Because as we know here in the Lowcountry, and as people finding out all across the country, restaurants, bars, and shops like that are the heart of our communities.
Yeah, so the Biden, the transition team has been very, very cooperative and very, open to hearing what we have to say about it. And I feel like we've made some good headway. But the reality is this is an airline manufacturing issue, right? I mean, it's got nothing to do with restaurants. And whatever the attendant effect was to hurt the European Union, the reality is that their products are limited in their availability anyway. And all the inroads to this to Americas have been well earned over years, and it's been a great market for Europe. But Japan, China, and all of Asia, and in many other places in the world, these wines are in high demand. And if we can't afford to buy them anymore, then these European winemakers can say, "Well, let's explore other markets." And once those markets are established, those wines not only will go somewhere else, but they may never come back. So it really doesn't, I don't think, achieve the intended effect on the European Union. They can sell those wines anywhere they want. You know, it's not like there's an unlimited amount of them. So we've already seen some traction in that direction where we're losing some of the availability, some of the wines that we've been buying for years and years and years to other markets. So, you know, the tariffs, I understand, are trying to, I'm not a policy guy ultimately, but are trying to, put the heat on the EU to stop subsidizing the Airbus manufacturing. But what it's really doing, it's hurting us way more than it's hurting the EU. And I think the Biden administration sees that. So we're pretty hopeful that that he can just strike that off the table in the first 100 days.
Yeah, it's interesting how the tariffs, as you said, mentioned, geared towards ending aircraft subsidies. And yet they are hitting restaurants so hard in the middle of what is the greatest crisis that the restaurant industry has ever faced with the pandemic. I'm wondering, just as chef, owner, partner of Fig and The Ordinary, and so many people in the restaurant community, not only here in the Lowcountry, but really around the world. I mean, can you speak to just how real the struggle is to restaurants, bars, wine businesses, and more, as we are now, into the second year of the pandemic?
Yeah, and just to, policy or politics aside, right, this is something that the Biden administration can take care of and help the restaurant business on day one. And, because as of right now, I know that a new stimulus package has been passed, but much of the country still can't operate the way they want to. So, for example, here in Charleston, we have the ability to open our doors to indoor dining, outdoor dining. We have, some limitations to what we can do. However, there's no demand in the hotels. There's no tourism. And even though we're able to stay open, there's just no demand for our business. And especially in the winter, January, February, March, at the height of the pandemic, right, that we've ever seen, there's just nobody around, right? So we all need the help. But imagine being in Chicago or New York or even California, where this new stimulus package is being rolled out. That PPP money doesn't do any good to restaurants that can't benefit from it by being open, right? Because the whole idea is that this money is to offset costs, right, to apply it to rent, mortgage, payroll, utilities, et cetera. But if you're not operating and bringing money in, that's just one big loan that you have to manage and a liability. So that's why we're appealing to the Biden administration, saying, listen, okay, this is not going to save the restaurants by any stretch of the means, but this is one more thing that you can do in your first 100 days is to help us, give us as much support as we need to be as profitable as we can with this limited amount of business that we can actually do. So we're looking at, months and months and months, if not years, before we get back into full production, full steam. So if you think about this as a long play, it's like we've got to start making every attempt to make it better for us to rebound, because our community, like you said earlier, not unlike other communities in other cities and towns, is centered around our restaurant community in many ways. If you think about how much we contribute to the benefit of the city in so many ways, right? Making it a desirable destination for tourists, which obviously has a tremendous ripple effect throughout the community. But not only that, but the philanthropic, you know, position that we take in this industry. It's like what we've done for so many nonprofits and fundraisers and the small farmers and the fishermen. It's like, so, you know, ultimately, we're all struggling. And we're hopeful that the stimulus will give us the relief that we need. But ultimately, I think we just need the new administration to recognize the fact that this tariff on Airbus in the EU really isn't working for that against them. It's really, it's more, you know, causing stress domestically.
You touched on several things there in that answer that I have written down here for things I wanted to ask you about. I guess one of them, first of all, is has there been an unfair focus on the dangers in restaurants compared to other parts of our society when it comes to the pandemic? I mean, restaurants and bars are considered like one of the top five places to contract COVID, but at the same time, the ways that restaurants have gone above and beyond trying to implement safety protocols and limiting the capacity and trying to expand outdoor dining, do you think there's been sort of an unfair focus on restaurants? And because I don't think people understand the raw numbers of people that work in the hospitality industry across the country. I mean, it's more than the hotel and airline industries combined when you look at the number of people that work in the restaurant industry. Just wondering, has there been an unfair focus on restaurants as far as the danger?
Well, so I can't exactly regurgitate data with 100% confidence, but have you not heard that that most of the contracted viruses have happened in home gatherings?
Yes, and not in restaurants.
And I've heard that in restaurants, the traceability to restaurants is under 10%, if not less than that.
Yes, and that's what I've heard too. I mean, looking at some statistics, the data out there just saying that it hasn't come from restaurants. It's come, as you said, family spread and other gatherings like that. I mean, and I think about a place like Fig there on East Bay Street. I mean on Meeting Street. You don't really have the capacity to expand outdoor dining, do you?
No, we don't. We've got four little tables on the sidewalk. But let me just give you this for an example. Okay. So we've been dealing with this for this pandemic now since last March, pretty much. And we opened to indoor dining in the beginning of June of 2020. And since, you know, from June to December, we have 100 employees. And out of those 100 employees, we had a half dozen, maybe a little bit more, of positive cases in our restaurants. And these are forward-facing frontline workers, right? But the protocols that we have in place at the restaurants, and many other of our peers do, are pretty strict, right? And we're really, you know, we're really diligent about the sanitization of the restaurant, the mask wearing, obviously, but, and of course, you know, how we handle the guests is we insist that they participate in our protocols. Mm-hmm. But if you think about the volume of people that we see on a daily basis, weekly basis, compared to nothing, just plain and simple, the volume of people that we see and the lack of cases that we've had internally. Now, it has spiked, but I'll tell you this. Almost every single case that we've had internally has not been a spreading case, there hasn't been other employees that have contracted it from the person that they've worked next to or near. It's all been isolated to what's happened to them outside of work. And the workers that have been working alongside of somebody who's become ill have not gotten ill as well. So it hasn't been spreading in the restaurant. So we're pretty confident. I feel safe. I've got a new baby. My wife was pregnant for much of the pandemic so far. And, you know, I feel very comfortable. And so she's been nervous the whole time, but I feel very comfortable that our protocols are really holding up. So, yeah, I do think it's unfair. I think it's certainly unfair when you see that, music venues can open up. And bars, I think, are a different story, right?
Right.
The way you collect at a bar, mm-hmm. At the bar itself, in close proximity to the bartenders. I think that there has to be some delicate balance of what exactly is allowed and what isn't. But for the most part, I think restaurants are if the operators are taking it very seriously, and you can figure that out the minute you walk in the front door. Mm-hmm. If you walk in the front door of a packed restaurant where people are like just, you know, packed to the hilt, probably not taking it as seriously as somebody who has spaced out tables, has sanitizing stations, you know, every 10 or 15 feet, signage about how to, you know, what the protocols are. I think those restaurants are doing a great job. And I do think that, well, certainly I'll say that I'm grateful that we've had the opportunity to invite people into our restaurants during this time, because had we hadn't, we would certainly be closed for good.
Wow. You know, you also mentioned the philanthropic aspect of what you and so many other restaurateurs do. I have seen you and talked to you many times over the years at Gourmet and Grapes out at Kiawah Island for the Hollings Cancer Center, as I emceed and hosted that for 11 consecutive years. And I, over the years, have seen so many chefs doing so many things for so many nonprofits and charities here in the Lowcountry. I mean, can you quantify how much are you in the BC days before COVID? How often you were hit up to help out philanthropically, and how much of an impact that would have on these nonprofits, what you guys are not able to do right now, and what they're not able to do, obviously, also.
Well, it's tough to really quantify what we as a community contribute, but you know, I can throw some numbers out, like at that Hollings cancer at Gourmet and Grapes. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the last year we did it, how much did we raise? $1 million.
$1 million, yep.
In one night. And do you remember I got up on stage and said, hey, listen, I'll throw another dinner in. At the end, we auctioned off one more dinner that I would cook in somebody's home for 12 people, and I think that went for $20,000.
And it's just amazing how generous that chefs, I mean, you guys are so busy anyway, and then you have to bring all that stuff out and set it up, and then the offers that you make and the generosity that you show. I mean, it's an integral part of the philanthropic community here in the Lowcountry, what chefs do for nonprofits and charities.
Yeah, you know, but listen, at the end of the day, we're part of a community. And we're on the receiving end of so much love all of the time from so many people that it's just, it feels like it's one big, you know, really happy give and take. And it's part of our job description in many ways, and we're happy to do it. But I know that what the absence of these events has affected organizations like Feed the Need and Gourmet and Grapes and even Lowcountry Local First. There's been it's been the first tea we do a big fundraiser for. And these organizations have really had to reinvent themselves to keep themselves going during this time.
Well, we know Charleston is really one of the great restaurant towns in the entire world. We know that living here. So many people have found this out and have been coming here to visit. But as you mentioned, tourism is down, hotels and even restaurant attendance and such. And how big a deal is it that there won't be a wine and food festival this year?
We had it last year. Yep. And then that was the end of our spring. You know, quarter two, what some people may not know, that the second quarter of the year, you know, so from, you know, April to June, is we make almost half the money we're going to make for the year during that quarter.
Wow.
So that's the busiest time of the year, consistently from March 1 all the way through, it's all the way through June, really. So, but that's the time of the year we really get set. We really kind of get ourselves in a good position from the year. The summer can be up and down. And even though the holiday season and we have a good, you know, fall tourism, you know, push, it's not the same as the spring. So having that stripped from us last year was devastating, right? And we'll probably miss out on a good bit of it this year. And the Food Wine Festival is one of those, it's the weekend where we go from holding our breath from the last 3 months to kind of like feeling like we can breathe easy again, right? So without that week, you know, it's going to be hard to feel like we can jumpstart our year. But listen, we've all reinvented our businesses a little bit. We've all found ways to save money, cut costs, keep our doors open. And I'm feeling pretty optimistic as a community that, you know, we can weather the next couple of months. You know, we're going to need all the help we can get from the Biden administration and from, you know, from our local governments to kind of work with us to make sure that we can get the help we need.
Yeah. And you had mentioned previously that the amount of months or years it could take to recover from the economic hit that the pandemic has laid down, you know, that I remember last March, Chef Tom Colicchio, who a lot of people know from Top Chef, had predicted that if the pandemic was long term, that you could see 2/3 to 3/4 of restaurants go out of business in the end, because I mean, that's a business, as you well know, as the a partner and owner of Fig and The Ordinary. I mean, you work on the margins. Your profit margin is already minimal to begin with, and now you get the pandemic. I mean, how fearful are you? I mean, if the vaccines don't get rolled out quick enough and things don't transition back to some sense of normalcy as limited capacities continue for restaurants and stuff, I mean, how fearful are you that we're going to have permanent long-term damage to the restaurant industry in America and here in Charleston?
Yeah, well, you say like it's coming, it's here, yeah. It's happening, and it's happening at a great rate. You know, the optimism that I may have expressed moments ago pertained to my business and our fact that we've been here for 17 years, almost 18 years, and we've been able to put ourselves in a decent mindset to deal with this pandemic. But had this happened to our organization 10 years ago or before, we were still cutting our teeth, a fledgling restaurant, which most restaurants are. Mm-hmm. We'd have been done long ago. And it's not only that, it's that it's impossible. You're not going to make any money in this business for the next year. You're going to be trying to dig yourself out of whatever hole personally, professionally you've dug yourself into. And I think there's going to be a lot of people that just say, it's not worth it. I can't do it. I don't want to do it. I want to just shut it all down because it's already a difficult business, like you mentioned, to make a buck. But when that horizon seems so far away that you can't even fathom the next time you go to pay your own bills at home, I think many people are going to say, it's not worth it. And I think, you know, we are in the middle of it, but it's going to get darker before it gets better. And you think the vaccines are going to make a difference, and they will. But if you think about the timeline of that,
right,
we're talking about months and months and months before we can get our feet on the ground again.
And what about employees? I mean, there was a real push for the need for good food and beverage employees for a town like Charleston. There was already a shortage of that anyway. Now the employees don't have jobs, and I'm just wondering, do they come back? I mean, how desperate will that need be to keep employees who are good, who are trying to make a living, when you can't hire enough to keep the all of the employees who are looking for jobs hired in a great restaurant town like Charleston?
Well, you know, this is the million-dollar question. Is you'd think that as restaurants close, we'd have more opportunities to fill out our staff. So there has been moments during this pandemic where we had shrunk and grown our staff, mm-hmm. To try to try to grow our staff to be able to weather when one or two or three people during contact tracing, or four or five people on a team of 25 or 30. Decide that they need to, that they feel at risk and they need to go contact trace. You know, it wasn't that long ago where these tests were taking a week. So we would have to actually hire more people just to keep our doors open, because we would lose 10, 15, 20% of our staff for a week or more at times waiting for test results, right? So as we've been kind of ebbing and flowing with our staffing needs, we found that lots of restaurants have closed. Maybe there should be a dearth of, or a glut of applicants. And there just hasn't. And I think what's happening is that people are saying, you know, this once was a great opportunity to make some cash and make a decent living in the restaurant business. But maybe they're saying now it's just too, during the pandemic, it's too much.
Yeah. I mean, just another aspect that people may not consider for the challenges that the restaurant industry faces in the time of a pandemic, even as we maybe emerge from it later this year in some way, shape, or form, the struggle and the complications will persist for a while. And I can only imagine, I mean, congratulations, by the way, on your new baby. I mean, I can only imagine the amount of stress. I mean, being a new parent's hard enough, but being a new parent and a restaurant owner in the middle of a pandemic, while you've got 25% tariffs on European food, wine, and drink, I mean, it's tough right now.
Oh, I mean, listen, there literally are days where we don't know if we're going to have a future in the business, you know? And like I said before, you know, I'm an optimist, and I love our industry, and I love our position in this community, and I think all those things are going to help us, give us the best chance to get through. But there is going to come a time where, if we don't see this thing turn around, where we're going to say, yeah, maybe it's time just to take a knee. I don't know. It's hard to say. I mean, sometimes we think things are getting better and they get worse. And so if these new strains of the virus and things happen, you know, it's like, who knows what the future holds? What I do know is that we're stress managers in the restaurant business. We know how to deal with pressure. We know how to deal with adversity. And so I think we're well suited to be in this position, you know what I mean? but there's going to become a point in time where if we don't see the light at the end of the tunnel, it's going to be time to pull up stakes.
Yeah, and we've seen some.
And that's my perspective on it. I'm sure that other people, their ropes are shorter than mine. I've got the benefit of experience. But like I said, had this happened to us 10 years ago at FIG, I don't know what we would have done.
Yeah, and we've seen some long-term stalwart quality restaurants are already closed up shop and called it quits. So, you know, anything that we can do to help, which is why we've been pushing Restaurant Week a lot, just to help these restaurants and try to get, you know, takeout to go. And how sustainable is any kind of model with takeout, carryout, delivery? I mean, people try to do it to help out their favorite restaurants, support the restaurant community, but that's a Band-Aid when you're hemorrhaging, isn't it?
Yeah, at this point, everything's in one big bucket, right? Everything that we do to generate a couple more bucks is trying to fill that bucket up so we can empty it out again and pay our bills. And, you know, you can't fill the whole bucket with just to go. You can't fill the whole bucket with just indoor dining. So we're trying to find ways at every turn to save money, to make a smaller bucket, I guess is what I'm trying to say, and figure out ways to generate some kind of revenue through gift card promotions, through to-go sales, through in-house promotions. We're trying not to discount anything, but, you know, we've got to do what we've got to do to stay alive.
Yeah, and
every
the answer...
The one lesson we've learned here, and I'm sure everybody can relate to this at some level, is that we wake up in the morning and we say, how do we best navigate today's problems?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at the end of the day, all we can say is, how do we do? Because there's no momentum, there's no building. It's just like it's day to day trying to get through and make it happen.
Well, you know, and as you mentioned, the ancillary effects on nonprofits and charities and others who rely, you know, all the ancillary businesses that are feeders into the restaurant wine and food business. And it's pretty staggering. But we do know the quality because that's been recognized as a James Beard Award winner and FIG and The Ordinary, two of the great restaurants here in town. And you're one of the great chefs here in town. And before I end this conversation, I just have to ask you, you're a big fan of Elvis Costello, correct?
Yeah, I am, actually.
The reason why, and I know you don't remember this, well, you remember part of it. In 2011, you got to go backstage and meet Elvis Costello after his concert.
I do remember that, yeah.
Because I was back there with you. I was there with my late wife. We were standing back there along with you and another buddy, and Elvis was a little bit under the weather that day, but the concert was great. And I remember, Michael Adams is an Elvis fan, and we're standing there backstage to talk to Elvis Costello, and I just remember seeing you back there, and I knew you were a big Elvis Costello fan, so I just had to bring that up. I know you don't remember that. I was back there with you, but I remember that.
Well, I remember standing in that hallway for quite a while.
Yeah. Waiting for it to come out. Yes, we were. Well, I think he was a little bit under the weather, but he put on a damn good show, so that's true. And again, thank you for all you have done over the years, philanthropically speaking, because I have seen you many, many times there at Gourmet and Grapes for the Hollings Cancer Center and other charitable events where chefs step up and donate their services and their time and their food, and it's just tremendous. So thank you for all that you've done, and best of luck with the incoming Biden administration to get these 25% tariffs on European food, wine, and drink products gone as quickly as possible to save jobs and to help out your industry in the middle of a pandemic. It'd be something you'd be pushing for anyway if there wasn't a pandemic, but it's just another way to try to give you guys a little bit of assistance. So I really appreciate you taking some time to talk to us.
Well, I appreciate you giving me the time to speak, and it's always great catching up with you as well.
Well, you know, like I said, Charleston's a great restaurant town, and it's because of people like you. So Mike Latta, chef, owner, partner at FIG and The Ordinary, James Beard Award winner, great to talk to you, and our best wishes for the future, and thank you for spending some time with us, and hey, bon appetit.
Thanks, man. Take care.